This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, hand-roasting coffee in small batches since 1966. With 7 locations in Greater Portland, including new locations on Hawthorne and in Vancouver.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon could be the first state to provide universal health care. KBOO News' Lisa Loving spoke with Rachel Pagliari this afternoon about Project Vote Smart and its quest to put elected officials' politics on record. And the U.S. government is investigating rumors of alleged links between the Venezuelan government and one of the largest and oldest voting machine manufacturers in the United States.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,816 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 49,938 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A new report released by The Lancet puts the number at more than 600,000 civilians dead.
Happy Halloween. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 31st, 2006. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. As you know, today is Halloween, Dia de los Muertos, a time when the dead walk the streets. Tonight, KBOO is bringing back to life a Portland Halloween hallmark. I spoke with Chihiro Winbush, KBOO's PR and outreach coordinator, about the new look of an old party.
Well, the Boo Bash is sort of like the new, I call it the reincarnation of the Boo Ball, which for those people out there who don't know what the Boo Ball is, which has to be a pretty small percentage of KBOO listeners, that was the Halloween tradition of like, it was a party that was done for, gosh, a couple of decades, I think, and it stopped sometime in the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, something like that.
So tell us about what Holocene is going to look like.
Well, it's going to be... It's going to be pretty wild. We have this guy coming in, Tony Stacy, who's going to be helping us out, and he has this whole big production thing where, you know, anything you associate with Halloween, I mean, you're going to have, like, the fog trailing on the dance floor and through the corridors. You're going to have, like, you know, the coffin, from what I hear, like, the floating head, maybe, like, gargoyles off the front of the building, perhaps even, like, spiders descending from the ceiling, like little monsters. I mean, it's going to have definitely that experience. It's going to be, like, anywhere from 4 to 6 projectors shooting, like, every wall, ceiling, whatever, with different, like, Halloween-y or horror, spooky stuff.
Yeah, Isaac had this bright.
And, you know, it's just going to have that classic Halloween vibe in addition to sort of like the music that people will be experiencing.
And what are some of the musical highlights from the Boo Bash this year?
Well, I would definitely say the biggest one would be our headliners, who are called Fleshtone. They just had a huge write-up in the Oregonian A&E last Friday, for anyone who caught that. And it's this huge, I mean, it's like live, it's electronic, it's like people in crazy costumes, it's people dancing, it's puppets, it's like visual projection stuff. It's like a true, like, multimedia, full performance art, music thing. I mean, that's the one thing where, like, you really want to be there for that. Because we're broadcasting the whole thing live to share with the KBOO community. We have a pretty good range of stuff, from jazz to electronic DJs and live stuff.
All right. And finally, how much, when, and where?
Well, it's, so it's at Holocene, which is at 10th and Morrison. The broadcast starts at 9 o'clock, but the doors open at 8. It's $7 with a costume and $10 without, so definitely deck out in your Halloween gear, and you get a couple dollars off for the effort. Plus, it's cooler, and we have a lot of prize and giveaway stuff as well. So if you have a great costume, you could win a big prize at the event.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner, KBOO News.
Supporters of tougher immigration law enforcement and border protection rallied today for reform and for candidates who back it. The rally, sponsored by Oregonians for Immigration Reform, drew about 200 people to the Capitol steps. The demonstrators criticized lawmakers they say have failed to take action, along with the media. A number of candidates seek office or running for re-election spoke at the rally, including Mike Erickson, the Republican challenger in the 5th Congressional District. Erickson repeated his claim that Democrat incumbent Darlene Hooley co-sponsored legislation that would allow illegal immigration to receive Social Security benefits. Hooley has accused Erickson of distorting her record.
Protesters locked themselves to the door of the Mexican consulate in downtown Portland today in solidarity with the people of Oaxaca. KBOO News spoke tonight with Ben Hale, a demonstrator, via cell phone about breaking developments at the demonstration.
There are probably about 8 people observing and about 12 police, and then those 2 folks who are locked to the door. It does seem calm at the moment, yeah. Like a crowd is starting to gather, more people. Plenty of people are curious and don't understand why there would be some kind of protest at the Mexican consulate today. There are plenty of bystanders who are, or passersby who are just wondering what this is all about.
That was Ben Hale speaking tonight from downtown Portland.
A Senate commission has approved, in principle, a bill that would make Oregon the first state to provide universal health care with a system that contains cost. Every resident would get an Oregon health card to buy essential medical care, possibly as early as January 2009. Unresolved are details such as how much businesses and workers would contribute. The plan would combine federal and state Medicaid money with contributions from employers and employees in a pool managed by a board similar to the Public Utility Commission. Health insurers and contractors would be required to accept any Oregonian with a card and offer benefits including mental health care. The commission says the plan would reduce insurance costs for the state and Oregon businesses.
This week, University of Oregon law students are holding a fair trade symposium. The event's organizer, Aaron Greaser, says the point is that fair trade economically empowers individuals and communities, while free trade enriches only the powerful. For the Eugene Report, Amy Merwin has more.
On Wednesday, November 1st and Thursday, November 2nd, at the University of Oregon Knight Law Center, there will be a symposium called Fair Trade, Equity Within Reach. I'm speaking to one of the organizers, Aaron Greaser.
We're going to be showing a film on Wednesday evening with John DeGraff. It's called Buyer Be Fair, and it's really an introduction to fair trade certification and what it really means. It's a great introduction for people who don't really know too much about it and who want to get up to speed on what fair trade is and how fair trade works. And then on Thursday, we have a series of events. We have a fair trade coffee and chocolate tasting. So we have a bunch of different types of fair trade coffee, fair trade teas, and fair trade chocolate from all over the world that we'll be giving out for free sampling. And then we're also going to have fair trade bazaar. That's many local shops that sell fair trade goods are going to come and display and sell the goods that they have. Finally, we're going to have a fantastic panel presentation. We have a fair trade rice farmer coming in from Thailand who's going to be speaking about the impact of fair trade in his region of Thailand. We have a legal expert who's going to contrast fair trade and classical trade models. And then finally, we have a woman named Priya Haji. She's one of the luminaries in fair trade in North America, and she's coming out to speak about the transformative power that fair trade can have on the U.S. market.
So NAFTA, CAFTA, and the World Trade Organization are the boogeymen of free trade. How does free trade differ from fair trade?
Well, free trade, essentially, if you're going to break it down to its most basic bare bones idea, is that by reducing barriers to trade, you increase the ability to trade and therefore increase overall utility. So basically, people in importing countries get cheaper products and people in exporting countries get jobs. But fair trade is kind of builds off of that in the sense that there are a lot of structural inequalities that go on in countries where, especially in developing countries, and countries that produce what we buy. A lot of times they don't have good guarantees of standard of living, they don't have good guarantees of living wage, those kinds of things. And so what fair trade does is it essentially takes a micro view and goes directly to the producer level and creates a situation where an individual cuts out all the middlemen, like the buyers and the importers, exporters, and retailers buy directly from producers in developing countries that produce through fair trade cooperatives. So that way, a much larger share of the money goes directly to the community, and it's theirs to control how they see fit. So it's just amazing, like, what it's done. I was living in India last year, working in New Delhi with a lawyer there, and just got turned on to the fair trade movement there, and it is just incredible, Amy, what the impact that fair trade is having on communities, of kind of seeing how these communities essentially can take control of their lives. And a lot of times they're communities that are socially vulnerable. There are a lot of communities of refugee women who are producing fair trade products for the Western market.
Is the idea of microlending inherent in the fair trade movement?
It's related, but not directly. It's the same premise of Muhammad Yunus that just won the Nobel Peace Prize this year. A lot of the same premises are common with microfinance and also with fair trade, in the sense that through harnessing the entrepreneurial spirit, harnessing the economic power of the market, you can really drive change a lot faster than basically handouts and donation aid. It's really a new and exciting movement. And a lot of the fair trade organizations do operate with microfinance models.
When you look at the models of NAFTA and CAFTA and what it's done in taking jobs that have been done in America, outsourcing them to the cheapest labor force anywhere on the planet, wherever that might be, and then selling these products back to Americans, that policy devastates economies wherever they are. Could you compare that, please?
The impacts are not uniform, so it's kind of hard to make direct comparisons. But definitely the classical free trade model, the neoliberal free trade model that's pushed through NAFTA, CAFTA, and the classical WTO structures, it tends to concentrate wealth in the hands of the rich. And that's kind of what you see more and more, is that even though there's a marginal increase in standard of living in a lot of developing countries for people who are actually taking these jobs in the sweatshops and such, there's also a large decrease in the earning power and the job security that Americans have that is not offset by the lowered cost of imports. It's kind of a convoluted explanation.
No, it's actually a convoluted practice that you've explained very well.
Okay, thank you.
And so if people want to learn more about the Fair Trade Equity Within Reach Symposium, how would they do so?
So the easiest way to find out about it is by going online. Check out www.waynemorsecenter.uoregon.edu/fairtrade.
This is Amy Merwin.
State lawmakers should be barred from moving into lobbying until they've been out of office for a year, according to a task force charged with cleaning up Oregon's political ethics law. The Government Ethics Work Group, culminating a $224,000 review of Oregon's ethics statutes, agreed yesterday that the state should enact a revolving door law for lawmakers. That would require a one-year waiting period for lawmakers that can earn money to influence from their former peers. The revolving door proposal is one of several reforms which will be forwarded to the Oregon Law Commission on November 15th. Previous proposals to curb lobbyists entertaining of lawmakers bar transport or funds from a candidate's political committee and tighten rules against personal use of campaign funds will be forwarded as well.
A large and persistent dead zone of low oxygen water off of Oregon's central coast, which had been killing crab and other sea life, has finally faded away thanks to shifting ocean winds. The low oxygen conditions were of record intensity and encompassed a roughly 70-mile-long swath of water just off the coast. These conditions lasted for about 4 months, far longer than any previous dead zones tracked off of Oregon during the past 5 years. This, according to Oregon State University researchers, who have monitored oxygen levels through the summer and fall. A similar swath of low oxygen water occurred this summer in the Pacific Ocean off of Washington's Olympic Peninsula.
The region's new Environmental Protection Agency administrator, a former Dow Chemical executive, was greeted in Seattle by about 24 protesters in her first day on the job. Activists raised concern Monday about Ellen Miller's 1996 to 2004 stint at Dow and her subsequent work with Arista Life Science of Tokyo, a pesticide maker. Miller also served as chief deputy of California's Department of Pesticide Regulations. In 1995, she was named to head California's Department of Conservation, which oversees oil and gas production. Environmentalists are also concerned about reshuffling in the Office of Civil Rights and Environmental Justice for the EPA's Region 10, which covers Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. The office traditionally handles such issues as cleanup of industrial sites in poor neighborhoods where residents are concerned about exposure.
The American Civil Liberties Union is investigating the complaint of 5 Bellevue Community College students who say they were turned away from a rally in a campus building for Senator Maria Cantwell with Senator Barack Obama. The students were wearing T-shirts for Republican challenger Mike McGavick. They say they went to the event after their instructors canceled classes and instructed them to go. A spokesman for the college, Bob Adams, says Cantwell staffers were adamant about barring the students with the McGavick T-shirts. Adams says the school has asked the state attorney's general office to take a look at the situation. The ACLU says the event, which drew about 2,000 people, was an open forum and that students who were turned away had their free speech rights violated. The students have met with lawyers and are considering suing the school or the Cantwell campaign.
Senator John Kerry told a news conference in Seattle today that his remarks yesterday concerning the war in Iraq were a botched joke. But he slammed Republicans who portrayed his statement as a criticism of the troops. Kerry says he will not apologize to anyone for his criticisms of the president and his broken policy concerning Iraq. The U.S. senator, who was also President Bush's 2004 rival, noted that half the names on the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. died after government officials realized the Vietnam War was a mistake. Kerry says it was wrong for leaders to be quiet during the Vietnam War, and he isn't going to do the same now. He also says that anyone who thinks a veteran would criticize the 140,000 troops serving in Iraq and not the president's policy is quote-unquote crazy.
House Republicans are scaling back television advertising in three highly contested races, officials announced today. Those races include Representative Kurt Weldon's bid for an 11th term in Pennsylvania and open seats in Colorado and Ohio. Some of the funds will be spent to help other Republicans in races which remain competitive. In contrast to the Republican strategic retreat, House Democrats are expanding the number of districts where they're advertising. In recent days, they have moved into districts in Kansas and Nebraska, which have long been in GOP hands. Democrats must gain 15 seats to win control of the House and 6 to win control of the Senate on November 7th. Of the two, the Senate appears a more difficult challenge, and Republicans moved during the day to fortify their position there.
In the run-up for Election Day, 1 week from now, Project Vote Smart is hitting a snag in its quest to put elected officials' politics on the record. KBOO's news Lisa Loving caught up this afternoon with Rachel Paglioka of Project Vote Smart.
You are putting together the voters' self-defense system for this midterm election coming up a week from today. Tell us, what is Project Vote Smart doing and what is the voters' self-defense system?
Well, Project Vote Smart is a library of information about candidates and elected officials. And as we're making our way closer to the elections, we're putting up every single day more and more information for voters to look at before the November 7th elections. We provide information on candidates and incumbents, including biographical information, campaign finance data, interest group ratings from a number of special interest groups from every kind of political persuasion, as well as voting records and public statements.
Rachel, as you compile this, and now we're so close to Election Day, what issues do you see emerging at Project Vote Smart?
Well, we actually just completed one of our studies. It's called the National Political Awareness Test, and this study is testing one question of all candidates, and that question is, are you willing to tell citizens your positions on the issues? And unfortunately, we found that this is becoming a major issue, and candidates are becoming less and less likely to tell voters their positions on the issues. And so that's why we're kind of creating this database of information so that voters have a way to defend themselves against that. The major issue that we're seeing is that candidates are not willing to give this information out to their voters. So this is what we have to do to combat that.
We've noticed that here at the KBOO newsroom as well. Project Vote Smart is actually a very, very famous project for basically, like you said, cataloging the points of view of elected officials. And we've even noticed that in Oregon, even elected officials that would have been characterized as progressive are starting to choose not to file their points of view with Project Vote Smart. What is the rationale that candidates give you on that? Why they choose not to participate?
Well, we've been hearing from all across the country that candidates are actually being advised by their consultants and by their party leaders that they shouldn't get this kind of information to voters. And they're afraid of two different things. The first is that they don't want their candidates to stray from their campaign messages, those messages that have been spent so much time constructed. And also, they're also worried about opposition research. They're hiding this information from their opponents, but unfortunately, that means they're also hiding it from the voters.
That was Rachel Paglioka of Project Vote Smart. Find more on the web at www.votesmart.org. That's www.vote-smart.org.
Black voters are far less likely to approve of the way President Bush is doing his job than the general population. This according to an Associated Press AOL Black Voices poll conducted last week. They're also more likely to feel that the country is on the wrong track. Some say that's disheartening news for a Republican Party which has been trying to curry favor with minority voters in recent years. Black voters are also more likely to say that the Iraq War was a mistake and that recent disclosures of scandal and corruption in Congress will be very important to their vote. Black voters have historically voted Democratic, and their votes are critical to the Democratic hopes to win tight Senate contests in Tennessee, Missouri, and Virginia.
The chairman of Florida's House Rules Committee urged Republican Representative Ralph Arza to resign over a racist message left on a colleague's voicemail. Republican Representative Gus Barrio filed a complaint alleging that Arza used a racial epithet when referring to Miami-Dade County School Superintendent Rudy Crew, who was black. Arza has admitted leaving the message, but said he was drunk and felt deeply ashamed. Rules Committee Chairman Dudley Goodlett wrote in a report Monday that he has not decided whether to recommend expulsion and that he wishes Arza would act first. Goodlett said Arza gave him a written explanation for his actions and asked that the Rules Committee not act in haste when recommending his punishment. A special committee is scheduled to meet Wednesday and is expected to hear from Arza.
Voters in South Florida are lodging complaints about glitches in electronic voting machines. Several voters say the choices they touched on the electronic screens were not those that appeared on the review screen. Election officials say they aren't aware of any serious voting issues. But in Broward County, for example, there's no process for poll workers to quickly report minor issues and no central database of machine problems. A machine isn't taken out of service unless the poll clerk decides it's a chronic poor performer which can't be fixed. In Miami-Dade, two machines have been taken out of service during early voting. This from the Miami Herald.
A heckler who confronted Senator George Allen at a campaign appearance Tuesday was attacked by three of the Republican supporters in an incident captured on video. University of Virginia student Mike Stark approached Allen at an event in Charlottesville, loudly asking him, "Why did you spit at your first wife, George?" According to the witnesses, three men immediately grabbed Stark, dragged him backward, and slung him to a carpet outside a hotel meeting room, according to the video captured by WVIR-TV in Charlottesville. There was no immediate word on whether Stark was injured.
And now, live from Death Row, commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Scarier than any Halloween. Soon, children will dress up as witches, animals, or, given today's marketing, superheroes. Although a secular holiday today in the U.S., it began centuries ago in Central Europe, in the Celtic cultures of areas like Ireland, the Scottish Highlands and Hebrides, the Isle of Man, and so forth. The Roman Catholic Church set its All Saints Day before it, and it became All Hallows Eve, or Halloween. Today, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, which isn't complete unless a hair-raising movie is marketed around it. But as kids are painted, masked, and prepared for the day's events, many parents are really frightened by another prospect. That of Republicans stealing yet another election, this time using the electronic computerized voting machines, many of them sold and prepped by the Diebold Company. Today, thanks to the pathetic Help America Vote Act, which passed after the Florida debacle of 2000, states were forced to buy new voting mechanisms to ensure less spoilage of votes. But new doesn't always mean better. States spent millions of tax dollars, threw out their old mechanical clunkers, and bought new, sleek, glistening models, some with touchscreen technology. The new technology has actually made voting fraud easier, for over a dozen states have systems that don't allow a paper backup or trail. Thus, the groundwork has been laid for a countless number of votes to be electronically stolen, transferred, or simply deleted. Why not? Didn't these political thieves steal at least the last two elections? Investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who has examined the last two presidential elections in depth, argues quite persuasively that both were ripoffs. Indeed, Pallast now argues that the upcoming 2008 elections for president may be stolen as well. In his new book, Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and other dispatches from the front lines of the class war. Yeah, all that's the title. Palas writes of the 2004 election, the nasty little secret of American democracy is that in every national election, ballots cast are simply thrown in the garbage. Millions of them. Most are called spoiled, supposedly unreadable, damaged, invalid. They just don't get counted. In Ohio, there were 153,237 ballots simply thrown away, more than the Bush victory margin. In New Mexico, the uncounted vote was 5 times the Bush alleged victory margin of 5,988. In Iowa, Bush's triumph of 13,498 was overwhelmed by 36,811 votes rejected. In all, over 3 million votes were cast, but never counted, in the 2004 presidential election. The official number is bad enough, 1,855,827 ballots cast, but not counted, reported to the federal government's Election Assistance Commission. But the feds are missing data from several cities and entire states too embarrassed to report the votes they failed to count. Correcting for the underreporting of the undercount, the number of ballots cast but never counted goes to 3,600,380. And there were certainly more we couldn't locate to tote up. Why doesn't your government tell you this? Hey, they do. It's right there in black and white on a U.S. Census Bureau announcement released 7 months after the election. In a footnote, the census tabulation of voters voting differs, it reads, from ballots tallied by the clerk of the House of Representatives for the 2004 presidential race by 3.4 million votes. Children dressing up like imps or witches aren't frightening. They're cute. But stolen democracies and madcap schemes to wreak havoc from nation to nation on behalf of corporate greed is truly terrifying. The loss of over 650,000 Iraqis in 3 years of a mad, twisted war, that's terrifying. The imperial hunger that sends the rest of the world into sheer chaos, that's scary stuff. This Halloween promises to be but a pale imitation of the real horrors to come unless people fight to change this madness. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald and former White House aide Scooter Libby are separately asking a federal judge not to allow 3 years of background information in the case to enter into Libby's trial starting in January. In new court documents, Fitzgerald argued that he shouldn't have to explain why Libby was charged while others, including the source of the leak, escaped prosecution. Meanwhile, Libby said jurors shouldn't hear about a New York Times reporter Judith Miller's 85-day jail term for refusing to discuss her conversations with him. The court documents are an effort to keep the trial focused on whether Libby, the former chief of staff to President, Vice President Dick Cheney, lied to investigators about his conversations with reporters regarding CIA officer Valerie Plame.
The consumer advocacy group Public Citizen today filed a complaint with the Internal Revenue Service against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Public Citizen says the group failed to report taxable expenditures to help elect pro-business state attorneys general and judges. The group said the chamber and its affiliated group, the Institute for Legal Reform, has also failed to report grants to other political organizations in the 2000 to 2004 period. The chamber is known as a 501c organization after the section of federal tax code which governs it and groups like it. Generally, the IRS permits such groups to engage in partisan campaign activities, provided that the activities are not their primary function. They must pay taxes on their political spending or their net investment income, whichever is less.
Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting revealed today the existence of an advertising blacklist on syndicated Air America shows which air on ABC radio networks. Fair obtained an internal memo from ABC Radio to its affiliates, which shows nearly 100 corporations have a standing order banning their own advertising on the commercially progressive talk show network. The memo, dated October 25th, was provided to Fair by the Peter B. Collins Show, a syndicated radio show originating on the West Coast. Corporations listed include Hewlett-Packard, Walmart, General Electric, ExxonMobil, Microsoft, and McDonald's. The list totals 90 advertisers on ABC affiliates. Earlier this month, Air America declared bankruptcy. Fair says the ABC memo is evidence that advertisers' political preferences can potentially narrow the range of views presented in the media.
The new owners of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News say they aren't optimistic about a contract, setting up a possible newspaper strike in Philadelphia in less than 24 hours. The current contract with the Newspaper Guild expires at midnight. A strike could begin then, but it's also possible to keep working under the terms of the expired contract. The Guild is the biggest union at the two papers, representing more than 900 reporters, photographers, and other employees. Issues in the dispute include job cuts, pension freeze, elimination of seniority status for layoffs, and merging the editorial departments of both papers. The company says revenue isn't coming in as the new owners had expected when they recently bought the papers.
Immigrant advocacy groups are protesting an array of proposed federal measures, which they fear will sharply reduce the ability of some legal immigrants to become U.S. citizens. Among their concerns are application fees increasing, which could double to $800, a mandatory online filing system, extensive new paperwork, and a revised history and civics test. Some activists fear the Bush administration is seeking to tighten access to citizenship to bar potential new Democratic voters. Application fees have increased to $400 from less than $100 since 1998 and are set to possibly double later this year. Activists say that the proposed new online filing requirement will shut out many immigrants without access to computers and open the door to abuse. Under new rules, a 19-page form requiring to register an online account.
Halloween isn't the only spooky news for October. Consumer confidence in the economy weakened this month, as job worries offset the benefits from falling gasoline prices, a New York-based private research group said today. Consumers' willingness to spend depends largely on job security. While the job market has been steady, recent monthly reports from the Labor Department have shown slower growth. Employers added just 51,000 jobs in September, the fewest in almost a year, while the unemployment rate dropped down to 4.6%, offering a mixed assessment of the nation's job environment. A report on Monday from the Commerce Department showed that although personal incomes rose in September, consumers are saving rather than going on buying binges.
The Supreme Court heard a case that could redefine the scope of punitive damages. The debate on the award given to people on no basis of a tangible loss has been debatable in U.S. courts for 200 years. Philip Morris brought their case before the High Court today, seeking to reverse a nearly $80 million punitive damage award handed down by an Oregon court. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The case is Philip Morris USA versus Williams. In 1997, Jesse Williams died of lung cancer after 50 years of smoking Philip Morris cigarettes. Williams ignored the advice of his family and of news reports in the 90s that tobacco could kill. Before his death, Williams said, quote, "Those darn cigarette people finally did it. They were lying all this time." His widow, Mayola Williams, brought suit against Philip Morris on the basis that a public relations campaign deceived people into believing cigarettes were not unhealthy. Mayola Williams.
I've said it over and over again, is to carry out Justice Wisher, to bring to the public's attention that the tobacco company was frauding people and deceiving them.
Two recent Supreme Court decisions set guidelines on punitive damages. The court's decision in this case could determine dollar limits and punitive awards by companies who could be sued for negligence. The Supreme Court is deciding if the Oregon Supreme Court rightfully awarded Mayola Williams $80 million in punitive damages, 97 times what her compensation was. Robert Peck represents Williams. He says the $80 million is not excessive. He based his argument on the reprehensibility of Philip Morris's actions, which is also the opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court.
I think what we have here is reprehensible conduct beyond any measure of anything any court has looked at, and that the size of the punitive damage award must reflect that.
But Philip Morris argued that $80 million is an excessive amount because the jury took into account not only Williams, but all people in Oregon who could get sick or die from smoking cigarettes. Philip Morris says their due process under the 14th Amendment is diminished, that they'll be unable to defend themselves in the future against such claims. Theodore J. Boutrous, Jr. is partner at the law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Los Angeles. He filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of product manufacturers.
I was very encouraged that the court focused on this notion that a jury should not be able to use a case involving one person to punish a company for allegations and claims regarding a bunch of other people who aren't before the court. That's really a fundamental due process question, and it's an issue that comes up all the time in these product liability cases. So for the court to lay down some clear guidance in that regard, I think would be very helpful.
But Williams dismisses that argument, saying punitive damages must be large enough to act as a deterrence. This is a case dealing with big tobacco, but many big businesses are at the crux of the issue. Victor Swartz is general counsel to the American Tort Reform Association. He says if Williams wins this case, it could spur similar suits for other businesses.
It's very important for Merck cases, pharmaceutical cases, auto cases. It's not just about tobacco.
The courtroom was filled with interested parties. They include product manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, automobile companies, major corporations who could be liable for harm or the death of a consumer. This case on punitive damages will be the first such case in a Roberts court, where he could be the swing vote. Roberts showed skepticism in the reasonableness of the $80 million award. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
It appears that Portland police aren't the only officers who may need more crisis response training. A teenager carrying a Bible and shouting, "I want Jesus," was shot twice with a police stun gun and later died at a St. Louis hospital, authorities said. In a statement, police in Jerseyville, Missouri, said they fired a stun gun at 17-year-old Roger Holyfield after he ignored their warnings and became combative. They fired again when he continued struggling. Holyfield was flown to St. Louis Cardinal Glennon Hospital after the confrontation Saturday. He died there on Sunday, police said. After an autopsy today, the St. Louis Deputy Chief Medical Examiner stated he, quote, "didn't see overt signs of trauma or foul play," end quote, on the teenager's body and suggested the boy might have died from, quote, "excited delirium." Toxicology tests won't be complete for several weeks. In a report released in March, international human rights group Amnesty International said it had logged at least 156 deaths across the country related to police stun guns over 5 years.
Johns Hopkins University has suspended the Sigma Chi fraternity because of a Halloween in the Hood party, which drew protests by black students. The invitation to the party, posted on a website, encouraged guests to wear, quote, "regional clothing," with jewelry including bling bling ice grills and hoochie hoops. The party, held Saturday night at the fraternity house, featured a skeleton pirate hanging on a noose. Black student union members protested the party yesterday. Observers say that the image and the language on the invitation highlighted racial tension at Hopkins, as well as the strained relationship between the university and the surrounding community. Protesters held signs showing a lynching next to a picture of the fraternity's skeleton. University officials suspended all the fraternity's activities pending a full investigation.
The current time is 5:39. And now for another daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The Bushites and their right-wing cohorts are losing it. First, they lost Osama. Then they lost their focus on the war against terrorists by darting down the rabbit trail of Iraq. Then they lost Iraq to theocracy and civil war. Then they lost the support of the American people. So now, they've lost their cool. Not since Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew have we heard such vitriolic, vituperative, venomous assaults on perceived presidential enemies as we're now getting from Bush and gang. White House PR flack Tony Snow, for example, screeched that there are some Democrats, quote, who say we shouldn't fight the terrorists, that we shouldn't even monitor, question, or detain Al-Qaeda. Goodness gracious, Tony, who are these dastardly Democrats who say such treasonous things? Name them! Alas, Tony had no names. Then George W. chimed in, wailing about Democrats in Congress who voted against his illegal program of eavesdropping on the phone and email messages of millions of Americans. He claimed that, quote, 177 of the opposition party said, you know, we don't think we ought to be listening to the conversation of terrorists. Really, George? Name these miserable members who oppose tracking terrorists. Alas, Bush's press office could not name a single one. Still, he kept on. At a fundraiser in Nevada, Bush regaled faithful partisans by declaring that Democrats, quote, think the best way to protect the American people is wait until we're attacked again. Gosh, George, share some names with us. But alas, he could not single out anyone who had said any such thing. Next came Bush apologist Bill O'Reilly, declaring that the, quote, secular progressive movement believes, like Osama bin Laden, that America is fundamentally a bad place. Bill, who says that? Alas, he can name no one. This is Jim Hightower saying, get a grip, Bushites. You're losing it. Badly.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Stay tuned for Out Loud at 6 p.m. following this newscast. At 7, it's Prison Pipeline. Fall has arrived. If you live in the Willamette Valley or Columbia Gorge, stay inside with your Halloween candy. Clouds and rain all week with highs in the lows to mid-50s. You are listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The U.S. government is investigating rumors of alleged links between the Venezuelan government and one of the largest and oldest voting machine manufacturers in the United States. Michael Fox has more from Caracas.
The U.S. investigation comes after months of rumors of a supposed link between Smartmatic and the Venezuelan government. Smartmatic is the privately owned Venezuelan parent company of Oakland-based Sequoia Voting Systems, whose equipment will be used in next week's congressional elections in more than 16 states. Both Venezuelan and Smartmatic officials have denied any Venezuelan state involvement in the company. Smartmatic and Sequoia announced on Sunday that the companies had filed voluntarily with the U.S. Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States to dispel any doubts that may exist regarding the independence of the company. Rumors to the contrary appear to be based on a Miami Herald article from 2004, which claimed that at one point the Venezuelan government was part owner of a software company in which two Smartmatic owners also held large shares. According to Sequoia, this part ownership was actually just collateral for a routine loan received from the Venezuelan government. Sequoia was the first voting machine manufacturer in the United States to implement voter verifiable paper audit trail technology during the 2004 presidential elections. Smartmatic acquired Sequoia in March of last year. This is Michael Fox, FSRN Caracas.
Mexico's federal preventative police occupy key parts of downtown Oaxaca City. Meanwhile, residents in outlying neighborhoods continue to put up barricades and otherwise maintain control of the majority of the metropolitan area. Calls for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Oaxaca have expanded beyond state lines to the national and international level. Shannon Young reports.
Thousands of Oaxaca City residents marched yesterday afternoon to the city center from three different points to protest the presence of federal forces. When the march reached downtown, federal police launched tear gas and used water cannons against the protesters, who built barricades and set fire to vehicles. In response to the occupation of the central square, or Zócalo, some demonstrators set up an encampment on the esplanade of the Santo Domingo Church, a UNESCO World Heritage Site located some five blocks from the Zócalo. The Federal Preventative Police, or PFP, operation in Oaxaca City has so far left at least two dead, 80 detained, 60 disappeared, and around 100 wounded, according to local non-governmental organizations. Sara Mendez is a representative of the Oaxacan Human Rights Network. In this operation,
They used water cannon tanks that used a mixture of water with acid. They also used pepper spray, tear gas bombs, helicopters, small explosive devices, and bulldozers to remove barricades, etc. President Vicente Fox says the federal police are in Oaxaca to, quote, recuperate social peace and tranquility. Although federal and state officials claim that daily life in Oaxaca will return to normal soon, there's little proof on the street to back up that assertion. Schools are still empty, businesses are closed, and public transportation has not operated for the past 5 days. In a new attack on members of the press, police detained Daniel Mota Figueroa, a reporter for local daily La Opinión, this morning near the airport. His exact whereabouts and legal situation are unknown. Media reports indicate that those detained by the PFP have been scattered in different jails, and that some are even being held in the local military base. Both houses of Mexico's Congress yesterday passed a resolution to ask Governor Ulises Ruiz to step down. Ruiz still refuses to leave office and has responded to the congressional resolution by saying he will launch a legal challenge with the Supreme Court. Striking teachers who have been camped out at Mexico's Senate building since last month welcomed the congressional resolution in a Mexico City press conference.
Consideramos que el pueblo de Oaxaca ha sido muy claro y que no cederemos en la demanda central.
We will consider that the people of Oaxaca have been very clear and that we will not renounce our central demand, which is the resignation and imprisonment of the assassin, Ulises Ruiz. Until then, the teachers' wing of the Popular Assembly will not go back to classes.
Actions in solidarity with the popular movement in Oaxaca took place yesterday in front of Mexican consulates across the U.S. and in Vancouver, Paris, Frankfurt, and Naples. The leadership of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation issued a communique yesterday stating that rebels will close roads and highways tomorrow in the neighboring state of Chiapas. The Zapatista command is calling on sympathizers to take similar actions in other parts of Mexico and the United States. The rebel army has also announced a national strike on November 20th, the anniversary of the start of the Mexican Revolution. With Vladimir Flores, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca City.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki today ordered that all American checkpoints surrounding Sadr City in the northeast and surrounding neighborhoods in Baghdad be removed. According to a CBS News report, those checkpoints took weeks to put in place, and it will take at least as long to dismantle them. The Prime Minister, however, said it should happen in just a few hours. This from CBS News.
Israeli fighter jets stage mock raids over Hezbollah strongholds in Beirut and two southern towns yesterday. The warplanes dived low over Beirut's southern suburbs at least six times before roaring back into the sky. In South Lebanon, officials and witnesses reported Israeli planes staging mock raids over the towns of Nabita and Tayir. Eight Israeli jets had crossed the border and dispersed over southern and central Lebanon. The Lebanese army issued a statement saying its gunners fired anti-aircraft artillery at the planes in South Lebanon. Lebanon's official national news agency reported that Israeli planes released material to draw away heat-seeking missiles over southern Beirut. Today's show was the heaviest aerial incursion of Lebanon since the end of Israeli's 34-day offense this summer.
Negotiations to end the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula will soon resume. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that North Korea will return to the six-party talks. The announcement was made following a meeting today between negotiators from the U.S., China, and North Korea in Beijing. The talks aimed at persuading Pyongyang to stop its nuclear weapons program have been stalled for over a year. The nations participating in the rounds also include South Korea, Japan, and Russia. Tensions have risen in the region since the reclusive state test-fired a nuclear device on October 9th. The United Nations Security Council soon after imposed sanctions on Kim Jong-il's regime. Officials here in Seoul hope the resumption of talks will bring an end to the standoff. There's no word yet on when the new round of negotiations will get underway. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, South Korea, I'm Jason Strother.
Thousands of local people and Islamic leaders have continued protest against yesterday's missile attack on a religious school in northwestern Pakistan. The protesters say 80 innocent civilians were killed. Pakistan's military, which carried out the attack, claims the school was an Al-Qaeda training camp. At least 4,000 protesters turned out in the northwestern town of Khar near the site of the attack.
At least one person was killed and 14 wounded when vehicles packed with explosives blew up outside two police stations in Algeria. The simultaneous explosions took place in the towns of Rakhia and Dergana. It is the first direct attack on a police post in several years. Police believe it was probably carried out by Islamist guerrillas. Islamic groups began armed action in 1992 after the government scrapped a parliamentary election that the Islamic Salvation Front had been set to win.
Rioting mobs rampaged through a northeastern Kanga town yesterday, destroying 43 polling stations after a soldier killed two electoral workers in violence, which came after Sunday's presidential runoff vote. Individual polling places began to post results, but the official overall outcome isn't expected for days. FSRN's Joshua Kalampa reports.
President Joseph Kabila faced ex-rebel leader Jean-Pierre Bemba in a runoff. Some 9,000 candidates also vied for 500 seats in the country's new parliament. Kabila enjoys enormous support in the east of the country, while Jean-Pierre Bemba has consolidated support from the west of the country. Both Kabila and Bemba have said they will accept the results even if they lose. But Bemba's camp has already complained of some irregularities. International observers have praised the election as well organized, despite some disruptions. Bemba supporters have alleged that the international community wants Mr. Kabila to win to protect European and American interests in the mineral-rich country. The vote has been run in the northeast town of Bumba, where polling stations were burnt amid fraud claims. At least one person died on the election day in the protest over the alleged fraud in the area. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
Acquitted defendants from Rwanda's 1994 genocide are still living in a UN safe house because no country will accept them. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, based in Arusha, Tanzania, has convicted 26 people and acquitted 5 since 1997. Those cleared of charges are not allowed to return to Rwanda or to stay in Tanzania. The court cannot find a country willing to take 4 of the men.
Hundreds of thousands of shops across the India capital, Delhi, remain closed today as part of a three-day strike to protest the sealing of unauthorized commercial establishment. Vinod K. Jose reports.
India's highest court has ordered the government to demolish all properties which are illegally built. And when government started its demolition drive, thousands of traders hit the streets. The traders are on a three-day strike, calling the city government to stop sealing their shops. Demonstrators scuffle with the policemen as they try to breach steel barricades to register their protest. Police fired tear gas and used water cannons to disperse the crowd. Last month, a one-day token strike ended up with chaos, killing 4 people in the violence. The capital's business community is expected to lose over 15 billion rupees, the equivalent of approximately $350 million due to their three-day shutdown. For FSRN from Delhi, this is Vinod K. Jules.
Today marks the 6th anniversary of the adoption of the groundbreaking UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women and armed conflict, which called for greater involvement of women in peacekeeping operations worldwide. But half a dozen years after its adoption, critics point out that peace support operations continue to be an area where women are still underrepresented at all levels, particularly at the upper echelons. FSRN's Danuta Sofraniak reports from New York.
The Security Council urged the UN Secretary-General in its Resolution 1325 to appoint more women as special representatives and envoys to the conflict-ridden regions. It also called for the expansion of the role and contribution of women in the United Nations field-based operations, especially among military observers, civilian police, human rights and humanitarian personnel. 6 years after that, statistics prove the opposite. As of August 2006, the overall representation of women on professional posts assigned to peace operations in civilian divisions was at 23.6%. As of September 2006, women made up only 4.5% of civilian police and 1.8% of military contingents in peacekeeping operations. Moreover, no UN peace operation is headed by a woman special representative, and only one, the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, has a woman serving as a deputy special representative. One of the countries where this resolution is of particular importance is Burma, which has been ruled by a series of military regimes since 1962. Ying Lao is a refugee and a representative of the Women's League of Burma, an umbrella organization comprising 12 women's organizations from that country. After escaping the oppression in her homeland, she joined the Shan Women's Action Network in order to provide assistance for other women.
I believe that without the inclusion of women in political processes and public leadership roles, there will not be democracy or equality in our society or in Burma. Therefore, through my work as a young women advocate, I am committed to work hard to convince our male counterparts in the movement. I strongly believe that using UN Security Council 1325 will empower women and increase women participation in the struggle for peace and political change in Burma and Burma Democracy Movement.
War in Uganda has once been described by Ian Egeland, UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, as the worst forgotten crisis in the world, with 85% of the country's fighters being children. Betty Bigombe is a former Ugandan government minister named Woman of the Year in her country in 1993. She claims that although Ugandan women have moved from victimhood to the promoters of peace, they still need support and help, which the UN resolution can provide.
That energy, that strength, the world is that after this resolution 1325, finally the UN is giving us this platform, is trying to support our women in every way.
Critics of the resolution claim, however, that it has no teeth. In order to change that, it should be treated as a binding international law, which takes precedence over domestic law or policy. Janet Benshoff, the president of the Global Justice Center in New York, shares that view.
There's a big limitation to the enforcement of this resolution because it has been largely left to UNIFEM and UNFPA, which are UN agencies. The problem is these agencies work with countries. Countries that are so bad that the entire democracy movement is outside the country are not part of the 1325 UNIFEM training or the UNIFEM Violence Against Women money. So there's none of that goes to these Burmese women. They don't have any access to the UN agency to effectuate 1325.
Many also argue that the pattern of exclusion of women from their advancement in peacekeeping has been reinforced by widespread sexual violence, intimidation, and threats against women. Sally Mary is a professor of anthropology and law and society at New York University. She has just published a book looking at human rights and gender violence, where she calls for more protection mechanisms of women in peacebuilding. Experts agree, though, that Resolution 1325 indicates a growing realization that in conflict situations, women are more than victims requiring the protection of the international community. They are negotiators, peacemakers, and advisors whose efforts are vital to sustainable peace. Just as Haris Silajic, the president of Bosnia and Herzegovina, once put it, if we'd had more women around the table, there would have been no war. Women think long and hard before they send their children to kill other people's children. I'm Danuta Shafranic, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 31st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your information at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Our assistant producer is Mike Monkvold. Our wire editors are Dwayne Ponzi and Helen Honey. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporter Amy Merwin and Ben Hale. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Elisa Loving. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Be sure to tune in tonight at 9 o'clock for a live remote broadcast from the Boo Bash. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Eduardo de Landeros Tejere guest hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. He'll feature a panel discussion on immigration featuring representatives from the Minutemen, Oregonians for Immigration Reform, and VOS, the Workers' Rights Education Project. At 9 on the KBOO Bike Show, the guest is Joe Kermoski, also known as the Metal Cowboy. He'll talk about how touring the country with his kids brought him to a new point in his life. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues It's Happening Here, his series on fascism in the United States. His guest, Joan Boker, founder of Theocracy Watch, will speak about the intertwining of religion and government. At 11, it's Democracy Now!, and at 12 noon on Alternative Radio, it's a double dose of Democracy Now! As host Amy Goodman speaks on Breaking the Sound Barrier, Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. One final note, KBOO News is looking for more reporters to help us on election night, especially Southern Washington residents. Help us out by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. And as always, thanks for joining us.
Going to hang out with my girl, you know, chill.
Nah, man, don't hang out with the girl. I'm going to take you somewhere.
Well, where are you going to take me?
Hold up. I'll tell you right now.
All right.
Deck out in your funkiest Halloween costume for the KBOO Boo Bash. This fundraiser will be broadcast live and features a wide range of Portland's best underground musical talent, including Fleshstone, D&D, Evolutionary Jazz Band, DJ P-Disco, and much more. The party takes place at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison, on Halloween night, Tuesday, October 31st, from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. For more information, please check out KBOO on the web at kboo.fm.
It is 6:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Out Loud. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net. Also, Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. One more. In other words, women's books and resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, is your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center, offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org. Stay tuned for Out Loud.
Happy Halloween, and welcome to the Out Loud Show, KBOO's news and public affairs show focusing on the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, queer, and questioning community. This is Jeffrey Jewell, and tonight's guest is Michael Long from the Human Rights Campaign. Michael is the political co-chair for HRC's Portland Emerging Communities Committee, and he will be joining us to discuss the upcoming election in particular and the work of HRC in general. Before our interview with Michael, here's my co-host, Jeff Lee, who has a very scary news story just in time for Halloween. Jeff?
Thank you, Jeffrey. This story from the LA Times. Saturday in Sellersburg, Indiana, at his first campaign rally this election season, President Bush galvanized supporters in a packed high school gym by pledging to oppose gay marriage, a theme Republican candidates have revived in the wake of a New Jersey court ruling in favor of gay couples. Activist judges tried to define America by court order, Bush told the crowd of 4,000 of Silver Creek High School, flanked by local Representative Michael Sodrill, Republican of Indiana, who is running for re-election. Just this week in New Jersey, another activist court issued a ruling that raises doubt about the institution of marriage. We believe marriage is between a man and a woman. At that, the crowd went wild, shouting USA, stomping their feet and shaking dozens of red, white, and blue pom-poms. The New Jersey Supreme Court last week ruled that gay and lesbian couples in that state should have all the rights and benefits of marriage, leaving it up to legislators to decide whether to call such partnerships marriages or civil unions. Gay marriage was a motivating issue for social conservatives in the 2004 election, but has been overshadowed this year by the war in Iraq. Constitutional amendments banning gay marriage will be on the ballot in 8 states this November, including South Carolina, which Bush visited late Saturday to greet troops and attend a campaign fundraiser outside Charleston. Bush has appeared at private fundraisers for individual candidates, but now is launching a string of public rallies during this last week leading up to the midterm elections, speaking out on tax cuts, national security, and gay marriage, while playing to his base of conservative Republican voters in such strongholds as Sellersburg, Indiana, Statesboro, Georgia, and Sugarland, Texas. With Republican control of Congress increasingly in play, the president's visits and tone could determine the fate of a handful of close races. Republican candidates have distanced themselves from the president in recent debates, television ads, and closed fundraisers, as his approval rating remained below 40% this month. Party strategists say it has become increasingly difficult for the party to take advantage of the office of the president. Democrats in Maryland, Missouri, and Pennsylvania have launched attack ads that remind voters of their opponent's support for Bush. Michael Steele, Right for Bush, Wrong for Maryland, says one of the latest television ads from Democrat Ben Cardin, which features Steele praising Bush at the 2004 Republican National Convention. On Friday, California Democrat Jerry McNerney issued an invitation to Bush to return to the 11th District and campaign for Representative Richard W. Pombo, who he visited last month, because he reminds voters that both Bush and Pombo are satisfied with the lack of ethics and integrity in Congress. The campaign landscape has changed dramatically since the midterm elections of 2002, when Bush's approval rating was 64%. When Bush targeted battleground districts for massive, boisterous rallies, but he's been more low-key this campaign season. The more recent example would be the fundraising rally held on Thursday, which brought in $700,000 for the Senate campaign of Oakland County, Michigan Sheriff Mike Bouchard. The event, which was held in a catering hall half the size of a high school gymnasium and was more than half empty. And a follow-up to that is from the Associated Press. President George W. Bush has for months cast the November 7th congressional elections as a choice about just two issues, taxes and terrorism. Now, with polls predicting bleak results for Republicans, he's trying to fire up his party by decrying same-sex marriage. Bush is campaigning in Georgia and Texas this week as his political advisors balance the need to help Republicans in tight races against the president's unpopularity. Polls show Democrats have a shot at gaining the 15 seats they need to win the House of Representatives and may even win the six needed to take the Senate, all 435 House seats and 33 in the 100-member Senate are up for a vote next Tuesday. For decades, activist judges have tried to redefine America by court order, Bush said Monday. Just this last week in New Jersey, another activist court issued a ruling that raises doubt about the institution of marriage. We believe marriage is a union between a man and a woman and should be defended. The line earned Bush by far his most sustained applause at a rally of 5,000 people aimed at boosting former Republican Representative Max Byrne, voting record effort to unseat a Democratic incumbent.
So, once again, here we are during the elections, and it's time to bring out those scary gay people again. Just in time for Halloween, I guess. Wonderful, wonderful. Our tax dollars at work. Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate you bringing us that very frightening Halloween story. We're here with Michael Long from the Human Rights Campaign.
Hello.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. We're really pleased
to have you. Before we get into talking about, I know you want to talk about some of the local political races, et cetera, where HRC and Basic Rights Oregon stand on this. But first, could you tell us a little bit about the general mission of HRC?
Sure. The Human Rights Campaign is America's largest civil rights organization working to achieve gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender equality. By inspiring and engaging all Americans, HRC strives to end discrimination against all GLBT citizens and realize a nation that achieves fundamental fairness and equality for all. That's the basic fundamental strategy of HRC.
Great. And I understand we were talking before the show that the HRC is working with Basic Rights Oregon, that some of the Oregon races are considered very important.
That's correct. Actually, HRC has determined that Oregon is one of the leading states in which they wanted to focus our efforts because of the most recent legislative session with Karen Menes. So it was one of those things where HRC is strongly behind Basic Rights Oregon and has both providing volunteer efforts as well as financial efforts to assist Basic Rights Oregon in its strategy.
Great. And can you tell us a little more about Basic Rights Oregon for our listeners that aren't familiar with them?
Well, just think of what I just said about Human Rights Campaign and throw Oregon instead of federal in, and you basically have Basic Rights Oregon. Basic Rights Oregon is really, or BRO as we call it, is really working very hard to achieve equality for all of us here in Oregon. And so it has taken and is the kind of the lead policy area or policy group for the GLBT community in Oregon.
Right. Well, we've only got a week before a very pivotal election. So why don't we just let you get right into some of the local races that HRC is following. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the candidates, bring us up with any endorsements or anything, and tell us why they're important.
Sure. First of all, HRC itself, it doesn't actually endorse candidates this year. HRC is supporting Basic Rights Oregon's endorsement of candidates. The top candidate, of course, is our current governor, Governor Kulongowski. He has been one of the strongest supporters of HRC and GLBT rights in general. In his first term as legislator, he actually introduced the first GLBT legislation in the 1970s, and as close as we were last year to achieving success. Unfortunately, we had Karen Menes in the House, who, as Speaker of the House, decided that it wasn't going to come to the floor for a vote. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but in fact, there's a real there's a belief that if it had come to the House, it would have won, and it would have been signed by the governor, and we would have both an anti-discrimination legislation as well as civil unions in Oregon. So it's really tragic that it didn't get through. Which leads me to the next candidate, if I may.
Great.
Which is
Thank
Rob
you,
Brading. Rob Brading is out in East County in the Troutdale area. He is doing an incredible job running his campaign against Karen Menes, Last time, in fact, he ran against her 2 years ago with very little support from the community and very little money. He came within 4 points of knocking her off. And unfortunately for us, that didn't happen. This time, Rob is doing an excellent job out there running against Karen Minnis, and in fact is forcing her to spend over $750,000 in her House race, which is going to be the most money ever spent in a House race in Oregon.
Wow, what a hotly contested seat. That's very interesting.
So for all those people out there in East County, they need to really get in and help Rob win, because it's not just GLBT issues. He's so good on so many other issues, education and healthcare and the like. So it's really important that supporters get out there and help him.
Wonderful, thanks. Who else is on your list of local races that you're watching?
Well, one more at the state level, if I may, which is Virginia Linder, who is running for Supreme Court Justice. She is currently on the Court of Appeals, and is one of, in my opinion, one of the best judges we have in the state of Oregon. I've known her for years since I was in law school, and frankly, she has always been on one of the most temperate judges that I've seen. She's running against Jack Roberts, who was a former commissioner of labor. And he has a lot of name recognition, especially in the state. But she is just hands and above the candidate with the most experience, and is really and she's also a lesbian too, which helps a little bit too.
Interesting. Great. Are you ready to move on to some of the local races?
Sure, let's go.
Great.
Well, first of all, Tina Kotek in House District 44, she had a really strong primary challenge, but she's probably going to be elected very easily. But I want to mention her because she's one of our favorites. We also are really strongly supportive of Susan Bonamici out in Beaverton, Brian Clem in Salem, Vicky Walker, who's running for the Senate in Eugene, Tobias Reed, who's up in Beaverton. And then, of course, we have people outside of the Portland area, people like Gene Cowan in Lincoln City, Newport, Richard Devlin, who's in Southwest Portland, actually, Larry Galizio in Tigard, Brad Avakian in Beaverton in Portland. So these are all great candidates, and they're all the most important thing is they're really for equality in Oregon. It's not just necessarily what HRC or even BRO wants to have. It's really what's best for the community, and they're strongly in support of fundamental equality for all of us.
Wonderful. It's my understanding that I met some people at a teen conference this summer. It's been interesting that Lincoln City was one of the most recent cities to pass an equal rights amendment.
In fact, that's correct. And then another one was Hillsborough, which was passed on July 15th. So, you know, the anti-discrimination amendments are on the way in different localities. But what the really important thing we need to have is have it across the board in throughout the entire state, so that when you drive from work to home, if you work in Beaverton and you live in Portland, you're not losing your rights along the way.
Wonderful. Thanks. If we could, let's back up to the gubernatorial race.
Sure.
I've understood from several people that they feel this is one of the more clear-cut races where equal rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people are concerned in the country. Can you explain why that's being said and perhaps get into the backgrounds of both the candidates and why it might be important for gay people to really watch this particular race?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In fact, HRC itself is nonpartisan. So to the extent that there are other people on either side of the aisle that are supportive of our issues, that is full equality, then they tend to be supportive. So Gordon Smith here in Oregon has been someone that's been very strongly supported. So the difference between Ron Saxton, who is running as a Republican governor, and Ted Kulikowski as a Democratic candidate, you know, it's clear. There is no difference. I mean, there's no agreement on the GLBT issues. It's my understanding that Ron Saxton has said that he will veto any anti-GLBT legislation and any civil union bills that are put in front of him. So the important thing for us is that there's a very strong chance that we may take control of the House. We already have control of the Senate, and I believe it's going to be held for the next legislative session. So it would be really tragic for us to get control of the Democratic House and Senate and still have it vetoed by a Republican governor. So I see this as a one-issue decision for GLBT, the community, and our allies, because it's important. And now that we don't want to wait another 8 years before we get a chance to have some full equality in Oregon.
Very, very important point. I can see why people feel that this is a really pivotal race, gay rights wise, for the entire nation to watch.
Exactly. And the nation is, you know, the nation is watching Oregon too. HRC has put a lot of funds here and a lot of people on the ground to help out Basic Rights Oregon. And BRO is doing a great job, by the way. They really are. They need to be congratulated for the work they've done.
Great. I understand a lot of catchphrase that I've heard you use several times is that we're seeking fair-minded representatives. Can you get a little more into what you're seeking with a fair-minded representative? We might want to kind of go through your list again of some of these people, and if you've got any specifics, you're more than welcome to share them with our listeners.
Sure. Well, in general, it's the idea that we are not second-class citizens, that we have exactly the same rights as others. You know, the discussion about President Bush and his thoughts on marriage, if I may, just to backtrack for 3 seconds,
certainly.
You know, the activist judges he's referring to, three of them, the three that were more willing to give us not only the rights to marriage, but actually the word marriage, were the three Republicans who were appointed by Governor Christine Todd Whitman at the time. The four who didn't were Democrats and one independent who decided that they didn't want to upset the apple cart too much. So they, the ones that said, well, you can have the rights, but we may not call it marriage. You may have to call it something else, and the legislature will have to decide that. But anyway, back to the issues. I think that if you look at how the races are being run, most people would say that the fair-minded legislators are those that are actually going to look at the issue and say, okay, not necessarily who's feeding me campaign contributions and who are, what are they going to do for me? It's basically what's best for Oregon. And I think most of us, if not all of us listening to this program, would agree that the best thing for Oregon and for all of us is to have equal rights. And that includes civil unions and or marriage, depending on how you look at that, as well as the right to not travel across the state and lose your rights and then gain them back again and lose them. I mean, the fact that Bend and Lake Oswego and Lincoln City and Portland have these rights doesn't necessarily mean that it's around the state. And we know that this is a very diverse state, so we need to have that protection throughout the state.
Yes.
As far as the different candidates are concerned, a couple of things I want to point out to you. In general, the people that have been in support of SB 1000, which was the Senate bill that was up for a vote, those are the people that are really here. The people that have supported us in the past, who have agreed that they will support that sort of legislation in the future. And another person that we might want to mention is Ben Westland, who did an incredible job for us. And if you may not have heard, but he has come out in support of Governor Kulongowski, as well as our former Governor John Kitzhaber. So, but I think the key is Governor Kulongowski being reelected, putting Virginia Linder on the Supreme Court, putting taking control of the House again by having certain people involved. Again, Susan Bonamici in Beaverton and Brian Clem in Salem and Tobias Reed in Beaverton, Tina Kotek in North Portland, Vicky Walker in the Senate to keep control of the Senate. Richard Devlin is another very strong supporter of us, and he has vowed to work towards equality for all of us. Larry Galizio, Brad Avakian, Chuck Riley are all in the Portland area. And then there's a list of people I can go. One of the people that I might want to mention also is Jeff Merkley,
Merkley, yes. He's a friend of mine. Great guy.
And Jeff, actually, if the Democrats take control of the House, he actually will be, as I understand it, the next Speaker of the House. And I couldn't imagine a more welcome change from Karen Minnis to Jeff Merkley. That would be ideal.
Well, as people that know me know, I'm involved in the affordable housing market, and Jeff Merkley has been very involved in that and is a huge supporter of that particular issue, which is close to my heart, too. I've met him on several occasions, a very nice man. I understand there's a lot of ballot measures this year, and ballot measures are really confusing to people. Can you give us a little bit of Basic Rights Oregon's stand on some of the ballot issues?
Sure. Well, we, as part of the there's a group of equality-minded groups, and one of them obviously is in support of voting no on Measure 43, the parental notification laws. That's another one. That's one that's very important to our group of communities. Another one that's very important is Measure 44, which Basic Rights Oregon is suggesting that it should be voted yes on, because it's the drug pool, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and expanding that. That's really a great program. For the most part, I think the rest of them, if I remember, 201, are all Basic Rights Oregon is either taking no position at all or is voting, suggesting that people vote no. You know, they're kind of, you know, the measures and referendum are always a little difficult because they're not really created by legislators or looked over by lawyers before they're put on the ballot. We vote on it, and then the people decide whether the courts decide whether or not they're constitutional or not.
I think ballot measures are very confusing to most voters. There's one or two that mean something to them, and the rest are get kind of a blur for them. Well, Michael, since we're running a little bit short on time, I'd like you to tell us a little more about how people can get involved with the Human Rights Campaign or with Basic Rights Oregon.
Okay. Well, for just the couple of websites you might want to look at. For this current election, there's the voteequality.com, which is Basic Rights Oregon, the Equality PACs website.
And that's www.voteequality.com.
That's correct. Thanks.
Okay.
And then there's also Basic Rights Oregon's general website, which is www.basicrights.org. For the HRC, Human Rights Campaign, www.hrc.org. And from there, you can get to all the information about the Portland area. We have our monthly meetings on the fourth Monday of the month, currently at Jackman Joe's over on Northwest 16th.
Okay.
It's a great place to meet, and I hope that people will get involved and come join HRC.
And when is that again?
It's Monday night, the fourth Monday of every month at Jackman Joe's.
Okay, great. And are there a few other HRC events that people might want to get involved in? Or
there are quite a few coming up. I suggest that you keep a lookout in the paper and in a variety of areas. But you can be assured that there will probably be events surrounding. There's a bowling event coming up. Pride will be at, of course. And then I think you might want to look for something to do with the L Word and the season premiere this year.
Oh, wonderful. That sounds very interesting. I'd like to also share with people, it's very, very important that you vote in this, and for that matter, every election, but this is a really pivotal election. I had failed to change my address on some paperwork and found the process of getting my registration updated to be very pleasant, very helpful. If you go to the website www.oregonvotes.org, they will refer you to people in each county that will help you. I must say my experience was the phone was answered on the second ring. My ballot was there the next day. Very, very helpful. So once again, that's www.oregonvotes.org. Very helpful. Make sure your registration's updated. And do you have anything else, Michael,
Just one other thing, and that is that, believe it or not, a few votes may make a huge difference. And in fact, our community may make the large difference this year as to whether the Democrats take control of the House. So please, please, please vote and support equality at the same time.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael Long from the Human Rights Campaign. We really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Jeff, I think before you get into our sign-off, and I believe you've got a Dixie Chicks number for us to listen to as we wind up our show here, I think you've got a message for someone special to both you and I.
I do. We would like to wish Arlene a very happy birthday across the miles, all the way out in Ohio, listening on the web at www.kboo.fm. Thanks for listening, Mom. And you've been listening to Out Loud, KBOO's Queer News and Public Affairs show. We'd love to hear your comments and questions and announcements. Please email us at kbooutloud@yahoo.com. On behalf of Jeffrey, tonight's engineer, Lisa Loving, myself, and everyone here at Out Loud, again, this is Jeff Lee. Thanks for listening, and join us in 2 weeks for an interview with recording artist Alex Dobkin. Until then, stay proud, vote, and live out loud. And now, here are the Chicks to tell you a little bit more about what their opinion is on this subject. And I'll keep paying.
long, 5 to 21. When I get back, we gonna have some fun. Up the river, daddy gonna do a swing. Baby, baby, tell me the truth.
Good evening. This is Ruth Kovach bringing you Prison Pipeline. You've just been listening to Blind Blake talking about doing a stretch, and when he gets back, he's going to have some fun. Well, I'm back, and I had some fun in Chicago. I was there for 2 weeks working on a project I call Hungry Neighbors, and now here I am back on Prison Pipeline. Reggie Bob sends his greetings, of course, and don't forget next week is the election week, so we won't have Prison Pipeline. Tonight, I'm going to be telling you a story about a vendor who sells the street newspaper of the homeless people in Chicago. It's called Streetwise in Chicago. It's kind of like our Street Roots is here in Portland. And the vendor's name is Greg, and he has a great story to tell because he was incarcerated and found his way back by being a vendor. But first, let's hear our usual message from Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
Of radicals and extremists. If the minions of the neocon right are to be believed, the struggle in Iraq, and by extension the Middle East, is essentially a war against what they call extremism. Even the verbally challenged President George W. Bush has argued quite strenuously against Islamic extremists. It seems like many in the right are trying out new terms every week to stoke the fires of fear about new and foreboding threats to the besieged American Republic. Extremists, Islamic extremists, Islamo-fascists, dead-enders at all. For politicians, words are weapons, which are used to sell images, much like Madison Avenue sells soap. Every so often, even the best product must be made new and improved. And why shouldn't they? Hasn't it worked before? We now sneer at the phrase, weapons of mass destruction. But several years ago, it rang in the head like a klaxon. Is it radical or extremist to fight against foreigners who invade your country and try to impose strangers who function as puppets for those foreigners? Why is the administration never seen as extremist for invading a foreign country based on false pretenses? Why isn't it viewed as extreme for its mad plan to remake the face of the Middle East? Why isn't its response for the desperate acts of 19 men, 9/11, of invading a nation that has nothing to do with that act seen as extreme? That it isn't is largely because of the obedient services of the corporate media, which sought obscene ratings by playing the fear card in waving the flag. They did so because their paychecks are signed by big business, and this administration has been good for big business. They served their corporate masters, but betrayed their publics. Yet this is hardly a new thing. Scholar and writer Michael Peretti, in his 2004 book, Super Patriotism, published by City Lights Books, Manic Bush Regime, to view a long history of U.S. extremism all around the world. U.S. leaders have long professed a dedication to democracy, yet over the last half century, they have devoted themselves to overthrowing democratic governments in Guatemala, Guyana, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti twice, Bolivia, Jamaica, Yugoslavia, and other countries. Peretti, these countries were all guilty of pursuing policies that occasionally favored the poorer elements and infringed upon the more affluent. In most instances, the U.S.-sponsored coups were accompanied by widespread killings of democratic activists. U.S. leaders have supported covert actions, sanctions, or proxy mercenary wars against revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Iraq, with the CIA ushering in Saddam Hussein's reign of repression. Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. U.S. interventions and destabilization campaigns have been directed against other populist nationalist governments, including Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Syria, Zaire, Venezuela, the Fiji Islands, and Afghanistan before the Soviets ever went into the country. And since World War II, direct U.S. military invasions or aerial attacks or both have been perpetrated against Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, North Korea, Yugoslavia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Somalia, and Iraq, twice, Peretti. There is no rogue state, axis of evil, or communist country that has a comparable record of such criminal aggression against other nations. That's scholar-writer Michael Parenti. In light of this kind of history, who are the extremists? In light of this history, who are the radicals? This isn't a war against extremism. It is a war waged by extremists. It is a war waged by ideologues drunk on power and willing to break a nation to prove their theories of the so-called free market. Iraq is essentially a broken state awaiting its final crack. Like hungry wolves, these dudes are looking for the next morsel to munch on. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Thank you, Mumia. One thing Prison Pipeline tries very hard to do is to bring the truth to us. If we want to find justice instead of injustice, if we want to find peace instead of war, the first step is to find the truth instead of the lies. And Mumia Abu Jamal certainly knows how to put the truth right out there in front of us. I went to Chicago to investigate some of the things that go on at a street newspaper. Their paper is called Streetwise. And I met with the coordinator of all the vendors, whose name was Greg. And he said to me, you know, Ruth, I want to tell you what Streetwise and being a vendor has done for me. And I think you'll be interested because I hear that you're an advocate for prison reform. I said, you bet I'm interested. So Greg told me his story, and I want to share it with you tonight. I want to share it with you because I know that you're friends and family and supporters of people who are in lockdown, and you're always trying to figure out why they do what they do and how they feel and what can you do to help them and what should you say and shouldn't you say and why didn't they do. So listen to Greg's story and see if this can help you with some of your insights. Greg was incarcerated when he was 30 years old and sentenced to 2.5 years for a nonviolent crime. He served 2 years of it, and during that 2 years, he spent 90 days in solitary at the state penitentiary in Mount Sterling, Illinois. He was released in 1998 with $20 in his pocket. His house was gone. His grandmother had left him a house, but he had been unable to take care of the taxes while he was in prison. And so his address was a shelter. He only had one friend. I said, gee, Greg, how come you only had one friend, you know? Don't you have family or loved ones? He said, during his drug addiction, his behavior was so bad that he had hurt every friend and every family member he knew, and they had ostracized him. They had given up on him. They had told him he was hopeless. They had told him that he was worthless. And he said he was believing it. And then he got busted for drugs, wound up in jail, and he sat there thinking, I am hopeless. I am worthless. I do deserve this. And what am I going to do about it? I'm going to try and get off drugs. Well, there was no rehab program in the prison to help him get off drugs. They just picked up a drug addict, threw him in the lockup. And there were drugs easily accessible. There were many ways to make connections and buy it. But Greg made the decision that someday he'd get out, and when he came out, he was going to be clean, and he was going to try to rebuild the connections and the relationships he had with his friends and family. So he didn't have drugs for 2 years. While he was in prison, he did a lot of reading. He did a lot of research. He learned to use the computer and search the web for information on drug rehabilitation and the effects of drugs. And he became even more fearful than ever of using drugs. And he said to himself, I was killing myself. And when they threw me in prison, they saved me from dying because I was killing myself. So Greg got out, and he did have one friend, and he had dried out, and he decided he'd do his best to get his life started without the help of this friends and family because he couldn't face them. So he bought the newspapers, and he answered the ads, and he set up interviews, and he scheduled 6 interviews within 3 weeks. And his resume looked pretty good because in his past he had acquired some skills and he was really ready to go be a worthy good worker. And he would get to the interview and they'd get to the part, what was his previous address, and he would say the state penitentiary, and that was the end of the interview. They didn't even say, oh, well, we have to look at that, or why were you incarcerated, or what kind of rehab did you have, or what have you learned. They weren't interested in anything. His last address was the state penitentiary. The interview was over. And Greg said to me, you know, Ruth, it just took the air right out of me when an interview was going so well, and as soon as they knew my last address, the interview was over. So he was very discouraged about the interviewing process. Another thing he needed to get a new start was some ID papers. And the prison didn't give him anything when he left. He had had things in his pockets, but they didn't give him anything back. So he went to the Secretary of State, stood in line for 2 hours, and he was told they can't help him. His records were lost. And maybe in 6 months, they'd be able to establish some ID cards for him if he had a permanent address, not a shelter. Well, this was pretty discouraging to him. Looking back, I said to Greg, you know, so why didn't you go to your sister then? No ID, no job, things are looking down, but here you are clean and dry. You know, why don't you go to your sister? He says, well, his sister probably was there for them, but he said his pride wouldn't let him go. He wanted to earn the respect of those that he had hurt. So finding out that there was no ID card, finding out there was no job opportunity, was a very critical moment, and all he really wanted was a hit. He looked for his drug connection. He was depressed. He was undernourished because he hadn't been eating. He didn't have money. His $20 was long gone. He had not had any drugs for 2 years, so when he made his connection, it resulted in such a strong effect that they found him laying down under a table somewhere and rushed him to emergency. A few days later, when he came to, he realized he had blown it again, that his chance to start over, his chance to be a decent person, his chance to earn the respect of his family had been ruined, and he never wanted to see or hear from any of them again because he was very much ashamed. And so he pulled the tubes out of his arm that they were giving him intravenous with. He snuck out of the hospital, barely dressed, and took to the streets to find more drugs, which, of course, he did. So he spent 9 months panhandling to get enough money together each day to get more drugs, and the cycle went on. During this panhandling, he found the corners, street corners, where panhandling worked pretty good, were often occupied by vendors who were selling this newspaper streetwise. And the people were giving them dollars and ignoring him. So he would stand in front of a vendor and spread his arms out and call the vendors names and mock them and make fun of their clothing. And he'd say to the people, this guy's got a job. You want to buy a paper? Go to the newsstand, buy a paper. I'm in trouble. I need help. Please help me. I need supper tonight. And he would try to do his panhandling and just sort of outshout the vendors. Well, he got through the 9 months like that, but in the meantime, it seemed every time he did this to one of the vendors who were selling the paper, they got to know him, and they'd be patient, and they would continue to encourage him. They'd say, hey, man, instead of getting in front of us and trying to get us out of sight, why don't, you know, if you can't beat us, join us. Why don't you try to sell these papers? So finally, after quite a bit of persuasion, of really friendly approaches by these vendors who he had been so rude and insulting to, he went to an orientation. And when he got to the newspaper office where they gave the orientation, there was food, there was a welcome. They all said, oh, you're going to be one of us, that's great. They were willing to share tips on how to be successful. And he said to himself, I can play this game of being a good vendor. I'll be nice to the guys. I'll get the free meals here. I'll sell the papers, and I'll get enough money for my drugs, and maybe I can do my drugs somewhere inside out of the rain. And so that's exactly what he did. He would sell enough papers every day to take care of an $11 a day room that he could pay for now, find his drug connection, go stay high until morning, and then get up and go back and sell papers, and that was his lifestyle for about a month. The place he was staying for $11 a day was, I guess, what a lot of you might think of as a flop house when you hear descriptions of such places. He describes it as three floors of the depths of depression. Well, here he is with this new lifestyle, and guess what? I said, what? Greg said, you know, Ruth, sounds like I had it made. I had friends, I had food, I had money, I had my drugs, I was happy. I said, so were you happy? He said, no, I was miserable. I still had no contact with my family. I still had no way to face them with respect. I still had no future. And so I decided that the life I was living was killing me. I knew that the first day of prison when they brought me in, that the drug life was killing me. How come I forgot it for 9 months and thought it was a good life? So he wanted to live. And he went to a rehab service place. And he said when he went in there, he had gone without drugs for about 3 days. And he knew he couldn't do it by himself. He needed a rehab program. And he said he went up to the lady who was taking the names at the desk, and he said, help me, you've got to help me right now. I'm killing myself. And he said, at first she said, yeah, everyone that comes in here is killing themselves. They all know it, and they think if they tell me they're going to kill themselves tonight, then I can do something about it. She said, well, there's a waiting list. It'll be 90 days, and there are 400 people ahead of you on the list. Well, Greg said, 90 days? Lady, if you make me wait 90 days, I'll be dead. And she said, just call me in 30 days and we'll see where you are on the list. Well, he couldn't wait. He called in 2 weeks. And she told him, not yet. And then he called again in 3 days. Not yet. And then every 3 days. Not yet. And then finally every day. And then finally he just went there in the morning and stayed there all day. And after 1 month, 2 weeks, and 3 days, and 2 hours, after the lady had put his name down as number 400, she put him ahead of 175 folks, and he was soon able to enter the 28-day program. He had won her over by convincing her that he really, really wanted a rehab program. And she explained to him that what she had done maybe hadn't been fair to some people, but she was betting on him as a person who really wanted to change. Well, after the detox, Greg knew that he had to do more than just sell the papers. Now, the money that he would earn selling papers didn't go for drugs, and he improved the place. He got out of the flop house, found a little bit better shelter, and started to work with the other vendors. And they had known him as a bully. And although a few had encouraged him and brought him in and embraced him in the community of vendors, there were plenty there that remembered him as just being a rude addict who didn't have his life together. There was 170 vendors selling papers in Chicago, so there's quite a cross-section of personalities and experience. There's quite a turnover in the vendors because once they get on their feet and have enough income from it that they can clean themselves up and find another job. So the program is described as a program not just for homeless, but for homeless and people at the risk of being homeless. He spent all his time that he wasn't on the street selling the papers at the computers. He learned a lot about addiction, about the prison system, about the welfare system, about where the food banks were, and he started to share what he learned with the other vendors, directing them to better places to find shelter, directing them to good meals at the various food banks. And after a while, they all liked him, and he was doing good work, and he became the vendor coordinator. He has introduced programs for the vendors that offer free opportunities to learn to read, to learn to use the computer, and to send and receive emails so that they can reconnect with friends and family. And he encourages them by start with an email. Send your family an email and says, I'm working now, Ma. Because when they're selling papers, they are working. I'm clean now, Ma. I'm off drugs now, Ma. And he told so many vendors to send these messages on emails. He encouraged and built up their confidence that finally, a year after he became the coordinator, he actually went to his sister and reconnected with her. So now he's living in Chicago, coordinator of the vendors, been elevated to a paid position with Streetwise to coordinate these 170 vendors, and he's with his loved ones and his family. I went to one of the vendor meetings that Greg was in charge of, and he's just fantastic. He stood in front of these men and women and welcomed them. He embraced them with every smile and with every word. He not only invited them or announced there were programs to learn to read or to do job searches and so on, he actually encouraged them to do these things. He brought in guests that tell them about job opportunities in the area for day work that some of them can do. So I hope that you've all enjoyed my little success story of Greg, but I hope that you've learned from it that when your loved one who has been on lockdown rejects you and acts like they don't want to see you, sometimes it's shame, sometimes it's pride, sometimes they just don't know what to expect from you. And it takes a constant reinforcement of your encouragement and your love and your respect and your faith that they can change, just like the vendors gave that to Greg so that he could finally transmit it over to his family. You need to let your loved ones know that they've been through a bad time. You're not trying to look at the past and condone that whatever mistakes they made were their fault or someone else's fault. You're not trying to blame the system. You're just saying, I know you can do better, and I'm here for you to help you do better, and I love you and accept you no matter how long it takes or how hard it is. So that's my story of Greg. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to hear a little music right now, the County Jail Special by champion Jack Dupree. And then I have a few announcements to make.
Well, here I am, locked up in this county jail.
So here's Jack Dupree locked up in the county jail, and here's all our loved ones and the folks we know that are in lockdown. Some of them don't know how it happened or what they're doing there, but here I am. One of the organizations that keeps us informed that you've all heard of has been the Western Prison Project, and they have changed their name. They're now known as the Partnership for Safety and Justice. The Partnership for Safety and Justice continues to put things on the web that you can access and gives you information of some of the things that are going on. And if you wanted to send them an email, you could send it to alerts, A-L-E-R-T-S, alerts. I'll give you the whole email address, alerts@safetyandjustice.org. Of course, safety and justice is all one word. So once more, alert@safetyandjustice.org is the new way to send an email to what used to be the Western Prison Project. One of the bits of news they've told us is that the access has been denied in Oregon and barriers faced by people with a past felony conviction focuses on some key barriers faced by people with previous felony convictions. The report, the end product of hundreds of surveys, two focus groups, and extensive research, includes things about employment barriers, housing barriers, licensing, identification, court fees and fines, policy recommendations to reduce these barriers. I think it's a good thing for you to look at and learn about some of these things that this organization provides the information for you on. More than 650,000 people are released from prison and jail every year, and thousands are being released to communities right across Oregon. The transition back to the community is far from welcoming. For most returning prisoners, formerly incarcerated people face a range of laws and policies that undermine their ability to become active and productive community members. And this is exactly what Greg faced. He came out vowing, hoping, planning, determined to make a good life for himself, and having trouble doing it because of some of the laws and some of the procedures, the bureaucratic structure. Another announcement that King from the Western Prison, used to be called Western Prison Project, but is now called Partnership for Safety and Justice, was a plea to write to the Oregonian about prisoner deaths. Three Oregon State prisoners died in September under circumstances that are being investigated by authorities. Two men died of apparent suicides while being confined in disciplinary segregation units. They're called DSUs. It's a prison within the prison. And both of them were eligible for release in 2007. One of the three deaths appears to be still under investigation, although it's hard to say, because there does not appear to be any ongoing media coverage. Three deaths in any other organization or state agency would prompt some journalistic investigation, and these deaths in prison should not be an exception. So we're asking that you write to the Oregonian and ask for better coverage. The Oregonian needs to hear from its readers to know that we think deaths in custody are important stories, and that the reporters are in the best position to ask hard questions. And a quick letter to the editor can make a difference. Some talking points might be that we applaud the attention the Oregonian has given to a recent death in the Portland police custody. It's an important story, and we need to pay the same amount of attention to deaths in custody that appear in prison. Three deaths within 2 weeks certainly constitutes a reason to ask deeper questions about safety inside Oregon's prisons. The Oregonian can press for full disclosure and full accountability for these deaths. The Oregonian reported that state police were investigating, but we still haven't heard the results of the investigation into one of these deaths. Can't the Oregonian look more closely at this investigation? What happens behind prison walls is of interest to all Oregonians. Deaths in custody are a very serious issue. So these are two of the little news releases that the Partnership for Safety and Justice are encouraging you to get involved in. I have another little note announcement, and then we'll be going to our music and leaving. This one is an announcement that I'll just read to you. Living Yoga is hosting its annual fundraising event. It's not a stretch to imagine a global community of yoga and human kindness. November 17th, 2006, at the Governor Hotel. Living Yoga is a nonprofit yoga outreach program that takes yoga as a tool for transformation to prisons, drug and alcohol rehab centers, homeless youth, and others who would not otherwise have access. The keynote address and the concert by Bo Lazoff, founder and director of the Human Kindness Foundation and the Prison Ashram Project, author of We're All Doing Time, and recording artist, will be the focus speaker. The concert starts at 8 o'clock. The tickets are $25. You can call 503-546-1269 if you want more information about this event. I thought it would be of particular interest to all of you because I got some good feedback that when Bo Lazoff, founder and director of Human Kindness Foundation, was our guest on Prison Pipeline, we've played his music. We know that the work he's done is very good. Here's your chance to see him and hear him. And now we're going to have to say goodbye. Next week is Election Day. Go vote. And if you have nothing else to do, go vote. And if you have many things to do, go vote, because that's what we have to do to try to make any effort at all to get some changes in these very serious issues. Reggie Bob and I will be back with Prison Pipeline on November 14th, and we're going to sign off with a little music by Junior Wells, who is a Chicago Blues fellow that I talked to about when I was in Chicago. So anyone who's getting a tape of this or later hears about it from Chicago will know I remember Junior Wells and I'll remember Chicago. And good night.
Run for my mother. Tell her the shape I'm in.
It's 7:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Run for my mother. Ooh, tell her the shape I'm in. Well, I'm locked up in this county jail. Ooh, well, well, and I haven't got no friend. Yes, when you're locked up in jail, you ain't got no friend. I'm way down here in this county jail. Well, everything will be all right. Just phone my mother and she'll take the chance. Being in jail, but your friend treats you so low down. I don't mind being in jail, but your friend treats you so low down. Don't you ask them for no favor? Ooh, well, well, they'll even stop coming round. When I got the news, it was just about 4 o'clock. When I got the news, it was just about 4 o'clock.